Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Matthew Rothschild, editor of the Progressive magazine, who assesses the enormous pro-union protests in Wisconsin and their capacity to re-energize the U.S. labor and progressive movements. Nicole Porter of the Sentencing Project, who discusses the record number of prisoners incarcerated in the United States and reform programs designed to reduce the number serving time in prison. And T. Kumar of Amnesty International, who looks at signs of unrest within the oil-rich kingdom of Saudi Arabia as people challenge autocratic regimes across the Middle East and North Africa. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Following an anonymous internet call to protest inspired by the Middle East uprisings, Chinese police cracked down with major force on political dissenters and the international media. The online appeal for a Jasmine Revolution urged protesters to support reform by strolling past a McDonald's in Beijing and 22 other sites in mainland cities. Shanghai police used whistles to break up an estimated 200 people, but some say it is unclear whether they were protesters or onlookers. A U.S. journalist was punched and kicked in the face, and more than a dozen other reporters were roughed up, detained, and delayed, not only by Beijing police but by others in plain clothes who appeared to be security officers. Nicholas Bekelin, Asia researcher for Human Rights Watch, told The Guardian newspaper that he saw little connection between the Arab revolt and the situation in China. China has one of the most sophisticated and extensive censorship systems in the world, which is why most people there were not even aware of the protest appeal. Well-known blogger Tiger Temple said that these controls prevented the Chinese from having the same level of political awareness as Egypt prior to the revolution. Muhammad Yunus, known as the father of microfinance and a Nobel Prize-winning economist, has survived an attempt to oust him from the bank he founded in 1983, which lends small sums of money to the poor people of Bangladesh and other parts of the developing world. According to the Guardian newspaper, Yunus was asked to step down as managing director of the Grameen Bank. The 70-year-old was charged with irregularities in operations by the finance minister of Bangladesh. Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina also accused Yunus of treating Grameen as his personal property. Fueling the controversy, a Norwegian documentary accused him of transferring Norwegian development funds from Grameen Bank to another venture without prior approval in 1996. However, the Norwegian government said an inquiry revealed no wrongdoing. The Bangladeshi government, which owns 10% of the Grameen Bank, requires retirement at age 60. Sources close to the bank said that opponents tried to push through a decision to oust Yunus based on his age at an executive committee meeting in Dhaka on February 28th, but the decision was defeated. The Grameen Bank currently has 8 million borrowers, 97% of them women. The attacks on Yunus come at a time when the once-hailed microlending model faces increased political hostility due to onerous conditions on borrowers, like those that led to suicides in India's Andhra Pradesh state last year. Supporters charge that the efforts to oust Yunus are part of Bangladeshi Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina's attempts at payback. In 18 out of 20 U.S. metropolitan areas, housing prices are falling again, according to the most recent Case-Shiller Index. Political gridlock and pressure from the financial industry have so far kept any solution to restore a normal housing market off Congress's agenda. Since the end of World War II, housing values have generally risen. Now, that process has shifted into reverse. According to American Prospect magazine, one-third of all homeowners now owe more than their property is worth, with 7 million facing possible foreclosure. The carelessness of banks to properly process paperwork, as they sold off loans, has resulted in many foreclosure cases taking up to 2 years to close. The Obama administration's 2009 Home Affordable Mortgage Program, or HAMP, urged banks to provide loan modifications to fewer than 700,000 homeowners. That's only 10% of those at risk, and half of those homeowners are expected to default. The program is voluntary to the banks, which prefer to disguise their balance sheet losses rather than offer homeowners enough relief to keep their homes. Professor Adam Levitin of the Georgetown Law School has proposed one possible solution: to amend the bankruptcy law to permit homeowners to go to court and get their mortgage reduced to the current value of the home. Banks face a loss either way, but it would help distressed homeowners stay in their houses and curtail the decline in housing values. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
For more than 2 weeks, large numbers of Wisconsin union members and their supporters from across the U.S. have converged on the state capitol in Madison to protest Republican Governor Scott Walker's effort to slash state workers' rights. On Saturday, February 26th, an estimated 100,000 pro-union demonstrators swarmed the Capitol building, making clear that the outcome of the fight over union collective bargaining rights in Wisconsin will have consequences far beyond the state's borders. Similar efforts by Republican governors to diminish union rights are underway in Ohio, Indiana, Florida, and Tennessee. Even though Wisconsin unions had agreed to all of Governor Walker's proposed salary, health insurance, and pension cuts to address the state's $137 million budget gap, Walker has refused to back down on his demand to take away most state employees' collective bargaining rights. 14 Democratic state senators who left Wisconsin in mid-February to deny the GOP-controlled Senate a quorum and a vote on the governor's anti-union legislation remain out of state in Illinois. Several recent national public opinion polls have found that a majority of Americans oppose the Republican governor's campaign to take away collective bargaining rights from labor unions. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with Matthew Rothschild, editor of the Progressive magazine, which is based in Madison. He assesses how local and national unions have responded to Governor Walker's challenge and the capacity of these historic protests to re-energize the labor and progressive movements nationwide.
Actually, the amazing thing is there's been a sit-in and a sleep-in and an occupation of the state capitol building for 12 nights now. That's gone underreported. And also underreported is just the sustained magnitude of these protests. 10 to 12 days ago on Tuesday, there were 10,000 people. And it just gradually built up from there till a Saturday ago, there were 75,000, and this Saturday, there were 100,000. These are sustained mass protests for union rights, the likes of which we haven't seen in this country since the 1930s. And yet, the corporate media has not given it its due.
From your perspective, Matthew Rothschild, what is the bottom line in what this fight is about? Republican Governor Scott Walker says his objectives are for long-term sustainability with the state budget, says the state of Wisconsin is broke. But of course, it's a lot more about unions, their power to negotiate, and his effort to really eviscerate public employees' unions' ability to engage in collective bargaining.
Yeah, it's not a budget bill at all. It's a union-busting bill. In fact, all the concessions he's asked from the unions for budget cuts, they've already agreed to. They agreed to take cuts in the health care benefits. They agreed to put more into their pensions than they had been before. Actually, they agreed to the amount that he was proposing just to call his bluff. And it became clear when he didn't accept their concessions that what he's after isn't solving a budget problem, which isn't that great anyway, and he's made greater by giving tax breaks to his buddies and sending back $800 million in high-speed rail money that the federal government wanted to give him, but he doesn't care about that. What he wants to do is get rid of the unions, and he's trying to get rid of the unions in a couple specific ways. First, he's getting rid of some people who would be eligible for the union, public sector unions like limited-term employees at the university. But the two primary ways he's assaulting the unions in this bill have nothing to do with saving the state a dime. One would require annual recertification votes for every single public sector union. And that never happens. I mean, when you join a union, you get a majority of people to sign a union card. And you're a union and you don't need another election until a majority of union members say, we want to decertify. But he would require a new election every single year, which would tie the union up in knots. And secondly, he would defund the unions by making it illegal for any public sector employer, not just the governor, but any county exec or mayor, from deducting union dues from people's paychecks. And that's the primary way that unions get their money. They deduct the dues out of people's paychecks. So this is just a very Machiavellian way to strangle unions. And the mainstream corporate media haven't really spelled out these specific ways that they're trying to do it. So it all seems kind of fuzzy. But once you lay it out like that, it's obvious this isn't about budget cuts or saving money. This is about destroying unions. Now, Why do they want to destroy the union? They want to destroy unions for a political reason, because unions typically are supporting the Democratic Party, and this is a Republican governor. But it's much deeper than that. It's a primary economic motive of corporations and the Republican Party to get rid of unions so that people would be forced into a race to the bottom and have to go hire themselves to the most abusive employer who pays the worst wage and doesn't offer any benefits. That's paradise as far as corporate America goes.
Matthew, when you look at President Obama's, what I think many would characterize, tepid response in terms of only saying a few words about these massive protests in the big fight for labor union rights, what's the feeling on the ground in Madison about Obama and what he pledged to do when he ran for president, which was to stand by working people?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of disappointment that the president hasn't shown more vocal support. I mean, we've all seen a clip of him saying the year before he got elected, while he was on the campaign trail talking to a union group, that, you know, if there's a picket line somewhere in America, when he's president, he's going to get his walking shoes on and join the picket line. Well, he's 2,000 miles from the picket line here. You know, he could stand up and be more forceful in his speech. He could come out here. He could send Joe Biden out here, certainly. I mean, that wouldn't have cost him a thing. And yet, we're not seeing a lot of national figures out here other than Jesse Jackson. And the people who've been out on the line here for 10 days, 12 days, now almost 2 weeks, need that kind of reinforcement. And so when Jesse Jackson was here inside the Capitol, that was tremendous. Or when Ed Schultz on MSNBC was broadcasting from here, that was tremendous. But certainly getting the full force of the President of the United States, who was put in power by progressives, put in power by union people, certainly would be something that would be welcome here, to say the least.
A lot of people looking at the enormous outpouring of solidarity and militant protest in Wisconsin are seeing a spark that could be fanned into a fire, noting that working families in this country have suffered a loss of income, stagnation over a whole bunch of decades since the Reagan tax cuts for the rich. The tax cuts seem to be, you know, continuing on under President Obama. Do you think what's happened in Wisconsin could be that spark to move progressives and labor unions away from a defensive position to go on the offense against policies which are redistributing wealth upwards from the poor and middle class to the wealthiest sector?
I do think this is a huge watershed event, because up until now, people were just taking it lying down. You know, there are 15 million, 16 million people officially unemployed and have been for a couple years now, and they haven't been in the streets. There are 5 million or 6 million people who've been thrown out of their houses because of the shenanigans of the Wall Street bankers, and they haven't been out in the streets. The middle class has gained no income, really, in real terms over the last two or three decades, where the top 1% is made out like bandits, and still people haven't been in the streets, still taking it lying down. But finally here in Wisconsin, people aren't taking it lying down. And then around the country, we saw all these solidarity rallies this weekend, which shows that people are really waking up. And that's why I think ultimately Governor Walker will go down as someone who terribly misplayed his hand for corporate America, because corporate America would rather rip people off while they're sleeping than wake people up and fight them over it. And now they got a fight on their hands.
That was Matthew Rothschild, editor of the Progressive Magazine, based in Madison, Wisconsin. Read the magazine's coverage of the pro-labor protests in Wisconsin at progressive.org. The United States has the highest incarceration rate in the world, which currently stands at 2.3 million people. By comparison, the incarceration rate in China was 186 per 100,000 in 2009, while in the United States, the rate is 743 per 100,000. But in recent years, officials have begun seriously considering ways to reduce that number for a combination of reasons, including court orders to alleviate overcrowding, budget deficits, and the introduction of more humane and effective methods of crime reduction. After decades of steady increases, 24 states achieved a decrease in their inmate population in 2009, leading to 48,000 fewer inmates in state custody from 2008 to 2009, although the number in federal custody rose 3.4% to 208,000 over that same year. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Nicole Porter, State Advocacy Coordinator for the Sentencing Project, which promotes reform in sentencing law and alternatives to incarceration. She discusses some successful prison reform programs and considers the policy changes that are likely to reduce the prison population further in coming years.
We've been tracking these trends for a while and have noticed that about since 99, there has been some sort of exploration among state legislatures in some parts of the country to address their large prison systems. But certainly in the last few years with the financial crisis and states really starting to look at where they can cut costs, that looking at correctional systems is a primary way to do that because our correctional systems have grown exponentially in recent years in the last 40 years. And lawmakers have looked at ways to cut costs, and some of that involves sentencing reform in terms of slowing down the number of people who enter prisons and how long they stay there.
Can you say anything specific about the different reasons the prison population has declined at least a little in the past few years? I know California is under a court order to reduce overcrowding, and it also has a gigantic budget deficit.
In some respects in California, it's been because of the court order. And because that sort of discussion has been waged in the courts, there's been a lot of examination of how California can address its large prison system and the overcrowding that's resulted from its sentencing policies and the fact that the state just doesn't have enough resources to manage such a large prison system. So one of the things that California is looking at is changing sentencing reform and looking for ways to cut costs. I mean, in a state like California, the reality is that there are too many people in prison, and many of those people aren't there because they've committed violent crimes. Sure, that's a large part of the population, but it's not the only part. California has a large number of parolees who revoke back to prison on an annual basis, and they're revoking back to prison not because they've committed a new crime, but because they have difficulty in managing the conditions of their parole. That has to do with paying their fines, being employed. There's all sorts of different conditions that someone on parole supervision has to comply with.
Nicole Porter, if 24 states reduced their population, did any stand out as particularly successful at doing that?
We put out a report last year called Downscaling Prisons that looked at four states, New York, New Jersey, Kansas, and Michigan, and a mix of administrative and legislative reforms that they had implemented since 1999. And in those states, they each decreased their prison population as a result of various different approaches. New York, they really reformed their Rockefeller drug laws a few years ago and really changed the way certain prison-bound offenders were sent to prison, so they identified alternatives for certain prison-bound offenders. New York, between 1999 and 2009, was able to reduce its prison population by 20%. In Michigan, they really strengthened sort of parole, strengthened alternatives to incarceration for people on parole who are revoking back to prison because they couldn't comply with the conditions of their parole. Kansas has a sentencing commission, and they restructured their state sentencing guidelines. Not all states have sentencing commissions, but Kansas does. And so that commission sought to divert the number of people convicted of drug possession to mandatory treatment rather than to prison. And then they eliminated sentencing enhancements for persons with prior drug possession offenses. And in New Jersey, they also strengthened alternatives for prison-bound people. So rather than sending certain people to prison, they identified alternative sanctions for them. Specifically, the Attorney General revised plea negotiation guidelines and allows now certain open pleas in lower-level drug zone cases. So again, that gives judges discretion and really allows for alternatives to prison for certain drug offenders.
Do you think in the past 2 or 3 years, the state's fiscal crises have been a factor in reducing the prison population?
You know, we were looking at this period starting in 1999, and states were implementing reforms even before the recession. I would say because of the current fiscal crisis, that has opened a window for reform in states that weren't sort of looking at this prior to the current fiscal crisis. So, you know, we haven't compared post-recession era to pre, but certainly there's been more activity in recent years among states driven a lot by fiscal concerns.
That was Nicole Porter of the Sentencing Project. Contact the project's Washington, D.C. office at area code 202-628-0871. Or visit their website at sentencingproject.org. widespread protests challenging autocratic regimes and monarchies across the Middle East and North Africa have now spread from Tunisia and Egypt to more than 10 other countries throughout the Middle East. However, the worst violence in this wave of unrest is now occurring in Libya, where the embattled leader Muammar Gaddafi, in power for 41 years, is engaged in a pitched battle with large numbers of his people allied with former members of the nation's military. Violently repressed protests in major cities soon devolved to an armed revolt, with large portions of Libya's territory now under the control of anti-Gaddafi rebels. The U.S. and United Nations have responded to the crisis by demanding Gaddafi step down from power and leave the country. The U.S. has imposed a freeze on Libya's U.S.-based assets, and the European Union is enforcing an arms embargo. But governments across the world are growing concerned about the potential for this surge of regional dissent to reach another country, the oil-rich kingdom of Saudi Arabia. The world's number one exporter of petroleum, with the largest oil reserves, Saudi Arabia is a theocratic state where religious police strictly enforce Sharia law. Beheadings are common and women have few rights. Although political parties and protests are banned in the country, there are signs that opponents have become bolder in their demand for change. Dozens of people were detained in January for engaging in protests in the city of Jeddah. A group of activists were jailed for openly announcing the formation of an opposition political party, and 100 academics have publicly called for sweeping reform. Now, activists using Facebook are trying to organize protest rallies across Saudi Arabia on March 11th and 20th. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with T. Kumar, advocacy director with Amnesty International. He discusses human rights conditions in Saudi Arabia and why he believes the U.S. and other nations around the world should immediately pressure the Saudi royal family to relinquish autocratic rule and establish a constitutional monarchy.
The human rights situation in the country is extremely disturbing. There are several hundreds, if not thousands, political prisoners there. Executions are common, beheading are common. Women in particular face numerous restrictions. They can't drive, and their upward mobility, even treating as equals, is not even heard of there. It's pretty much a controlled society. Media freedom is extremely limited. No opposition parties are there. No meaningful elections takes place. So you are talking about the similar situation that existed, say, in Egypt, Tunisia, or Libya. The only exception is they were ordinary people who were in power as dictators. Here, a kingdom, a king is there. They have dictatorial powers. So it's basically they are kings, but everything they have is the same thing that the other regimes that fell.
T. Kumar, how significant are the recent petitions, online petitions taken up, calling for a constitutional monarchy, opening up of the system, where there are also recent demands for new political parties to emerge? The regime has reacted by arresting dozens of people. And just recently, there's a Facebook call in Saudi Arabia for protest rallies on March 11th and 20th. How significant are these recent events in Saudi Arabia?
It's extremely significant. In this time of age, they can't block information coming out from different parts of the world, especially from the neighborhood. Facebook, Twitter, emails, you name it. We saw the uprising in Egypt, Tunisia, as well as Libya. Pretty much people came to know that their fellow Arab brothers are rising up against authoritarian regime. So now they also have the same motivation, and they also try to ask for regime change, or in some cases only concessions, organized through Facebook and other means. So it's not isolated. Saudi Arabia cannot be isolated from other issues that are happening, other revolutions that are happening in the neighborhood. And it's already having impact.
What's your guess as to how strong opposition groups are within Saudi Arabia, and the effect of them coming into the streets against strict orders of the monarchy and their police?
If you see what happened in Egypt, Tunisia, or Libya, There you didn't have any opposition movements. The only opposition movement in Egypt was Islamic Brotherhood, which technically had roughly 20 to 30% of support according to different sources. So you don't need to have an organized opposition movement to rise up. In Saudi Arabia, even though there are no meaningful opposition parties, that does not mean that there will not be any large-scale demonstrations or public anger spilling out into the streets. You can't predict, but if you analyze other countries, you can't rule out it will not happen.
For many decades, the United States has had a very close relationship with the Saudi regime, and certainly the United States has sold billions of dollars worth of armaments, high-tech weapons such as fighter jets and other hardware such as tanks. How would you like to see the United States change its policy toward Saudi Arabia, given the upheaval around the Middle East and the winds of change blowing there, the growing calls for people all over the world for the United States and other major powers to stop supporting autocratic and dictatorial regimes?
It is in the U.S. interest, long-term interest, to support genuine democratic reforms in Saudi Arabia and other countries. If the U.S. takes a different line because of Iran or because they need support from Saudi Arabia for a variety of issues, including economic, that means oil, and fighting against so-called terrorists, then they'll be mistaken. It's a short-term victory that they will have. Long-term, people are going to rise up if there are no meaningful reforms. So it's better for the United States to come quickly before there are people on the streets and getting killed. So they should push for meaningful reforms right away and condition any aid, military aid or anything, on the assumption that they will improve democratic reforms, protect human rights, and give an equal rights to everyone. So it's better for the U.S. to get ahead of the curve and be with the people in Saudi Arabia.
That was T. Kumar, Advocacy Director with Amnesty International. Contact the group by calling area code 212-807-8400 or visit their website at amnestyusa.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut, 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.